advisement. We'll move now to the third case of the morning, number 03-3976, the United States against Wiley John Johnson.
Thank you. May it please the court. Oh, so I have to wait till the white light is on.
No, you're all set.
Okay. Wiley Johnson, Anthony George, and Columbus Malone all resided in an area of Gary that is commonly known as Concord, so named because there's a housing project named Concord Housing Project there. All three were allegedly members of a gang or group from that area known as the Concord Affiliates. The affiliates, of course, got their name from the same housing project that was in their neighborhood. That group actually did record and release rap CDs. They released at least two CDs. Another activity that a number of members of the group were involved in was the sale of crack cocaine, and that's what led to the filing of conspiracy charges against there were at least nine defendants originally, Malone, Johnson, and George. Even by the government's concession, were at the bottom rung of any ladder of organization. The identification of a conspiracy has been acknowledged in repeated decisions as one of the most difficult tasks for a prosecutor in a trial court. For an illegal conspiracy, there's never a written agreement, a contract, there's not a membership list, and no one punches a time clock. The sale of crack cocaine occurred regularly, I think all parties agree in that, in the Concord area in Gary between 1994 and 2001, and probably before and after that time. However, this conspiracy was charged specifically between 1994 and 2001. One of the reasons that the conspiracy is such an important charge here is that all three of these individuals, the evidence directly relating to them involved the sale of small amounts of crack cocaine. So I'm sure the court is aware, under the sentencing guidelines, the sales of their individual amounts would have resulted in a sentence of 5 years or less for each of the defendants. Because it's a conspiracy, the guidelines do contemplate calculating a weight distributed by the entire conspiracy over an extended period of time, top weight being 1.5 kilograms, which is not that difficult to make. The result of their conviction of a conspiracy was that George and Johnson each received sentences of 30 years, and Malone received a sentence of 24 years. Now, the issue of identification of a conspiracy has been addressed by this court in the past on numerous occasions, and they have pointed out certain factors that should assist the trial court in separating a conspiracy from just a repeated sale of drugs. It's our position that
if you can show a horizontal conspiracy here, is it necessary to show a vertical conspiracy? Most of these cases, and I think your argument goes to a vertical conspiracy, whether the sellers are conspiring with their source and so forth. Here we've got people who are apparently cooperating with each other. So is it really relevant to their liability to find that there's a vertical conspiracy?
I would say it's not relevant. I think they can be liable under either theory, a horizontal or vertical, but you still
They are taking turns in selling here, apparently. That certainly is some evidence of horizontal cooperation.
I would agree, but I don't think that by itself amounts to a conspiracy. In fact, in United States versus Thomas, one of the things that Judge Rovner addressed was a shared stake in the economic success of the enterprise. Now, I would concede that by taking turns and keeping lookouts, they're helping each other out at the time, but the analogy I would make is to a McDonald's franchise where the workers may cover for each other, would take turns at the register, but they don't have any success in the financial, any interest in the financial success of the franchise. I think it's perpetrating a legal fiction in a way to imagine these individuals as thinking beyond the immediate sale and the profits they'll be making that day. But I do think that that's necessary under the way the case law has developed. The points that the court has addressed in the cases cited in the brief, which have been called the plus factors, are the length of the time that the seller has been affiliated with the buyer, whether there was an established method of payment, the extent to which the transactions were standardized, and the level of trust between members of the conspiracy. And I would argue that those apply whether it's a horizontal or a vertical conspiracy. Now, unfortunately, the court has, in I think every fact situation that's been brought before this court, there's some evidence on some of those elements or those plus factors. However, the court has never really given a firm distinction about how many of those factors must be present, or I think it's more of a weighing factor that's been given to the trial court to make a determination. The fact in this case, there was a long-time affiliation of George Malone and the people who were alleged to be the leaders of the conspiracy. However, one problem with this conspiracy is it's a little bit difficult to identify who the buyer and seller were between these defendants and the other people. There was evidence that they bought from various suppliers who may have been affiliated with the conspiracy or may not have been. I think the government and the defendants all concede that Bobby Stuggs was the leader of the Concord affiliates and the conspiracy. However, I don't believe there were any incidents where any of these three defendants purchased directly from Stuggs. I'm not saying that that's a requirement of proving a conspiracy, but that is a factor that the court needs to consider.
How should we deal with the increase in professionalism when Bobby Stuggs was present?
Well, to me, that's an indication that that there is a conspiracy and Stuggs is involved, but during that time, none of these defendants were present. I think you're referring to testimony of Earlene Fears, who was an informant put in the area and observed pretty disorganized selling, except when Stuggs was there. It shows Stuggs is in a leadership role, but it does not establish any relationship between Stuggs and these individuals. Not to say they didn't know Stuggs. They all grew up in the same area and resided in the same area, but that by itself is not sufficient to make a conspiracy. I would concede, however, that there was a long affiliation, at least between two of these defendants and the conspiracy. Johnson was more in and out and had a more limited involvement if you're just looking at the first factor, the length of time affiliated. The established method of payment. There was no evidence that there was an established method of payment from either the street. I imagine the street sales were mostly cash, and there was some evidence of that, but not on any regular basis, or that these individuals would obtain their crack in any regular manner or for any standard form of payment. In fact, even the geographical area, although it was primarily in the neighborhood, there were sales outside the neighborhood as well. Anthony George had two videotaped sales that were near the Concord area but slightly outside the official area. I don't believe that either two or three there's any evidence of that specifically that the transactions were standardized. And the level of trust, I also don't believe there's evidence on. Other than horizontally, I would concede, as I've indicated, that they would warn each other, but I think that can equally be for self-preservation as opposed to any advancing of a joint enterprise. The other issue that I wanted to address was the introduction of the gang evidence. The government introduced not only evidence that there were the Concord affiliates, but that most of the affiliates were members of the Vice Lord or affiliated with the Vice Lords. This issue has been addressed by this court on several occasions, and I've been unable to find a case where it's been found unduly prejudicial. However, the government was kind enough to include in the appendix a number of the photographs here. The point I want to make on this issue is there was never an issue about whether these defendants knew each other or whether they affiliated. The issue was whether they conspired to sell crack cocaine.
I think, the evidence of gang affiliation is, I can't think of anything, more damaging in a jury trial. But I think here the gang hierarchy explained the chain of command.
But on my recollection, I don't think there was evidence of the gang hierarchy. They were all members of the Vice Lords, but I don't believe there was any testimony that Bobby Suggs or anyone else was any higher in the Vice Lords than anyone else in the alleged conspiracy. Suggs was in charge of the cocaine distribution and also was the leader of the Concord affiliate, but I don't recall evidence of any structure within the Vice Lords. I just wanted to refer the court briefly to a couple of the photographs, specifically Government's Appendix 3, and there are numerous photographs. In this case, we happen to have an all-white jury. We have pictures of black males, and they're not smiling. They're attempting to look threatening. This is going to be a factor that will influence jurors, as Judge Roedner pointed out. But does it prove anything other than that they knew each other, which was not an issue in the case? We don't believe that it does, and for that reason, we believe the introduction of the gang evidence was unduly prejudicial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. We'll hear now from Mr. Kirsch.
May it please the court, I'll respond to appellant's arguments in the manner in which they were raised. First, the sufficiency argument, and then second, the evidence of gang. The gang evidence that was admitted. A conspiracy is nothing more than an agreement to work together to commit an offense. In this case, the offenses that were committed over a period of almost a decade, the distribution of crack cocaine in the Concord section of Gary, Indiana. The evidence that these individuals, specifically Wiley Johnson, Anthony George, and Columbus Malone, together with approximately 20 other individuals or so, worked together to distribute and control the drug trade in Concord was overwhelming. They took turns when they were selling. They had a standardized way of doing business in that regard. They used lookouts. The Concord section was difficult to conduct surveillance in because of the dead-end streets, so they posted lookouts, some lookouts as young as 12 years old, who would yell popos or 5-0 or other warnings to the gang members and drug dealers out in the Hill section and on Court Street who were selling drugs as the customers pulled in to be serviced. There was a very standardized way of doing business in this case. They fronted drugs to one another. They shared drugs. There was testimony that when one drug dealer came up on the hill and he did have anything, another drug dealer would give that drug dealer who had no drugs some drugs to get him going that day so he could get going and then purchase some other drugs. They excluded outsiders, very important evidence of a conspiracy. Also, that point goes to the importance of the gang evidence in this case. The exclusion of outsiders was critical. CCA was involved in gang wars, particularly with the Bronx Boys. Bronx Boys could not sell on the hill. If you were not a member of CCA, you did not sell on the hill. It was that simple. Establishing that these defendants were part of CCA, that they were permitted to sell on the hill, was very important to establishing that these particular defendants were members of this large-scale conspiracy. There were violations issued for bad business. Again, evidence of a conspiracy, evidence of standardized way of doing business. If a customer was shorted, Bobby Suggs or one of his lieutenants would issue a violation, a beating or some other form of punishment, a suspension potentially, to gang members who were selling out on the hill. And they wouldn't be permitted to carry out bad business, which was bad for the business of the entire organization, not just for the individual that was selling the dime bag or the 20 to the customer who had pulled up at that moment. Very important evidence of the conspiracy was the fire at Cheryl Bridgewater's house. Cheryl Bridgewater testified that her apartment was set on fire in the middle of the night because she lived in that area and called the police. She got tired of it, tired of the people standing on the street day and night selling drugs as people would drive in and out, in and out. As punishment, Bobby Suggs ordered that her apartment be burned, and it was carried out. Her apartment was burned. It went up in flames. Cheryl Bridgewater afterward went to Anthony George and asked him, "Who set my apartment on fire?" And he responded something along the lines of, I know, or I would tell you, but I can't, because if I told you, it would break the CCA code. Again, evidence of a conspiracy, evidence of a drug dealing conspiracy. They set this fire, obviously, to protect their turf. Again, important to tie Anthony George to the gang, the CCA code. The code was more than the conspiracy. The gang really held this conspiracy together in this case. It provided a way for Bobby Suggs to issue his violations. It provided a way for these members to be accepted on the Hill to be able to distribute their drugs. And of course, they shared suppliers and customers. There were many suppliers through Bobby Suggs, but they would go to the same individuals. They would sell to the same customers. Danny Allison testified at trial that he was a regular customer up on the Hill before he started working with the government as a confidential informant. So many individuals served him when he came up there. He was a known customer. In fact, he rode his bicycle up there quite a bit, and they all knew him. So they shared customers. They shared suppliers. Mr. Schlesinger made mention of the tattoos. The evidence of the tattoos ties these individuals to the gang and to the conspiracy. There's nothing inherently inflammatory about these tattoos such that this court is taking issue with. There's no demonic symbol. There's no other racially charged symbols or something along those lines. The tattoos in this case were fairly innocuous. I guess it was a 5-point star. Anthony George had his nickname AJ. There was a dollar sign with one slash through it, indicating Vice Lord's affiliation versus the two slashes, which indicates Gangster Disciples affiliation. Those were the, I think Wiley Johnson on his hand had a tattoo of a crescent moon and a 5-point star, again, Vice Lord affiliation. There's nothing inherently inflammatory about these tattoos. And again, as I mentioned, I think the gang evidence was very important because it tied these defendants to a conspiracy that was controlled by gang members. The gang evidence showed the control of the conspiracy, and it also showed that these individuals were accepted into that conspiracy.
Regarding the drug possession in the fall of 2001, wasn't the amount of drugs consistent with personal use? And didn't Johnson have a drug addiction? In other words, what evidence is there of an attempt to sell that amount of drugs?
Well, Your Honor, the members of this gang were selling, at times, small amounts of drugs. Users would come in and buy $10 worth of drugs, which is typically more than the 10 milligrams that Wiley Johnson had on him. However, Wiley Johnson, throughout the trial, maintained that he wasn't a part of this conspiracy, that he wasn't around all the time, that he wasn't there, this and that. Well, October 21st, 2001, towards the end of the conspiracy, Wiley Johnson is arrested with crack cocaine in his pocket in the Concourse section of Gary, which is significant. It's significant for the time frame. It's significant to tie him to the conspiracy, to tie him to the area.
Well, he lives in, I mean, that's his area.
Well, there was evidence that he had moved to Atlanta, that he lived in the Glen Park area with his girlfriend. I think his girlfriend, in fact, testified that he lived in the Glen Park area with her. Wiley Johnson put on a witness who was his girlfriend who testified that he wasn't around there. And there's some issue in the briefs as to the boundaries of Concord. Well, the boundaries that appellants make issue with are the boundaries that I used on a map. And it was simply a map that I had cut out. It wasn't any defined boundaries, but Wiley Johnson, I think, was arrested on 15th Avenue, which was near the top of the map that I used to display to the jury to show the Concord housing project, the Hill area, and Court Street. And this was right there at the top of the map, but right in the middle, right in the Concord section of Gary. That was the significance of it. I think that it fit within the time frame of the conspiracy. And it was another small piece of evidence to tie Wiley Johnson to this conspiracy, to tie him to the Concord section of Gary, and to tie him also to crack use, crack distribution. It was significant in that regard. Unless the court has any questions, I ask the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Kirsch. You have 3 minutes, Mr. Schlesinger.
I have a couple points. Actually, when Wiley Johnson was arrested on that occasion, he was charged with public intoxication, and no drugs were found on him. In fact, I think his mother was in the car with him at that time. I understand that Mr. Kirsch is saying there's evidence of a conspiracy, but it still has to be tied to these defendants. And, for example, the Anthony George's comment about Cheryl Bridgewater's house burning, I think what he didn't refer to the CCA code. I believe what he said was he could not tell her on the code. Now, my inference from that would be the code that he wants to stay alive and someone might hurt him. I think there are different inferences that the court can take from the same evidence, but a lot of what Mr. Kirsch was talking about, the standardized sales, for example, or the organization, Earlene Fears testified that the sales were very disorganized during the approximately 9 months, I believe, that she lived in the area. It was only when Suggs came out there, and again, when Suggs was out there, I don't believe that there was any evidence that any of these defendants were present. Specifically referring to whether you had to be CCA or Vice Lord to sell on the Hill, you did not. Mr. Kirsch is correct that you could not be a Bronx boy and sell on the Hill, evidently, but as long as no one objected to your selling up there, there were people who were not from Concord or who were not affiliated with the Vice Lords who did sell on the Hill. We believe that this indicates that there was not a conspiracy and that the evidence was insufficient on that point. Mr. Kirsch also indicated that I referred to the tattoos. I did not, an oral argument I did in my brief, I believe, and I would concede that the tattoos are relatively harmless. I'm more concerned about the pictures of groups of young black males, and again, the inference, which the tattoos do to contribute to, the trial becomes these people are different from us, therefore you fear them, and therefore they must be guilty. They're members of a gang, therefore conspiracy. That does not amount to sufficient evidence to convict them of conspiracy.
It's an all-white jury, did you say?
Yes. Thank you. I would concede that black people would probably be afraid of some of those photographs, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. The court wants to thank all the counsel in this case.